Finding the women still alive 1 year on seems to have been a financial irritation to the firm, but the women, crippled and in pain, were regularly consulting doctors and buying palliative medicines. From USRC's perspective, it was too much. They quibbled every bill. The girls, Ewing warned threateningly, should be cautious about assuming that every expense they incur will be paid. The board of doctors had been expected to announce that the women were not suffering from radium poisoning, thus freeing the company from its responsibilities. It seemed that Ewing, whom Berry described as having a hostile attitude, certainly longed for that diagnosis. But to Ewing's frustration, even though the board kept subjecting the women to test after test, they found each one duplicated the previous results. Berry wanted the board to issue a formal statement that the girls had radium poisoning. It would be firm evidence that dial painters as a group were afflicted by it, which Berry and others could then use in the upcoming lawsuits for the girls' friends. But Ewing refused. "We are quite unwilling to have these findings used in connection with any other case," he wrote primly. As for the girls themselves, they were just doing their best to get through it all. They were subjected to a harrowing array of experimental treatments and tests. The physicians tried Epsom salts that made them sick, colonic irrigations and week-long assessments on their spines and excreta. The exams were usually conducted at Ewing and Craver's hospital, which meant the crippled women had to travel to New York. Louis Hussman told Berry that it is very difficult for Edna to go so far without injury to her. The last time she went to New York, she had to go to her bed as a result. Edna's beautiful blonde hair, by now, had become snow white. All the girls looked far older than they were, with faces that had curiously slack skin around their chins, where their jawbones had been removed. Only Grace seemed better than she had the year before. Although she had now had 25 operations on her jaw, they had failed to break her habit of smiling. She was said to be the happiest of the five by far. When she'd received the settlement, she'd said with determination, "People are now asking me if I am going to stop working. I do not intend to do anything of the kind. I'm going to keep right on at my job as long as I can, because I like it." She still commuted daily, with the bank being understanding about the time off she needed for her tests. Though the tests happened often, the girls never learned the results. "The doctors don't seem to tell me anything," complained Catherine. "I would like to know if I am getting any better." In fact, in many ways, Catherine was better, for she now lived quietly in a rural convalescent home set on a hilltop 12 miles out of Newark, which she called the Jewel of the East. She wrote that the setting inspired her to get well so she could enjoy hollyhocks and rambler roses and peonies and sunshine. The money had helped Albina too. She was described as being the picture of contentment that summer. Her pleasures were now her radio, goldfish, the movies, and short jaunts in the country, often with Quinta. At the present time, however, Quinta had been admitted to hospital. She was unable to sit up, and only family visitors were allowed. It not only meant that she wasn't available for jaunts to the country, she was also unable to attend court on behalf of May Canfield, as the other four women did in the summer of 1929. Quinta did, however, ask Berry to represent her.